Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. This podcast is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong's RegTech Lab, as well as HKU and Standard Chartered Foundation's FinTech Academy, the Asia Global Institute, and HKU edX's Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from the HKU Faculty of Law. Today's topic is the future of money and payments in the coming years. Our guest is Professor Yishu Yadav from Vanderbilt Law in Nashville, Tennessee. She's also the Associate Dean and the Robert Belton Director of Diversity, Equity, and Community at the Law School, and the Milton R. Underwood Chair and Professor of Law and Faculty Co-Director of the Law School's LLM program. Professor Yadav's research interests are in financial market regulation, securities regulation, corporate bankruptcy, with a focus on market structure, exchange design, payments, digital asset regulation, as well as distressed debt and restructuring. Prior to joining Vanderbilt's law faculty in 2011, Professor Yadav worked as a legal counsel with the World Bank in its finance, private sector development, and infrastructure unit. There, she specialized in financial regulation, insolvency, and debtor-creditor rights. Before joining the World Bank in 2009, she practiced from 2004 to 2008 in the London Paris offices of the law firm Clifford Chance and in the firm's financial regulation derivatives group. Part of her work in the area of payments regulation, she advised the European Payments Council on the establishment of a single euro payments area. Since joining Vanderbilt, Professor Yadav has served as the honorary advisor to India's Financial Services Law Reform Commission and on the Atlantic Council's Task Force on Divergence, Transatlantic Financial Reform, and G20 Agenda. She served as a member of the Commodity Futures Trade Commission's Technology Advisory Committee in the U.S., where she sat on the Distributed Ledger Technology and Algorithmic Trading Subcommittees. Professor Yadav earned her Master's in Law and Modern Languages at the University of Cambridge, after which she earned an LLM at Harvard Law School. She was a Vanderbilt University Chancellor Faculty Fellow from 2019 to 2021. And with that, Yishu, thank you so much for joining us.
Ajay, thank you so very much for having me. It is such a pleasure to be on the podcast today. I am incredibly excited to get to have this conversation with you and also to have my first real connection with HKU. So this is a very exciting opportunity for me. So thank you so very much for having me today.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What put you on the path you're on, and why is the future of money and digital payments so of such interest to you at this phase in your career?
I consider myself to be a pretty, dull, housebound kind of person, like not super exciting for your listeners. But I mean, I was born in India. I moved to the UK when I was very young. I grew up in Scotland, in Glasgow, which is just an amazing place to grow up. The big skill set, if you're a Glaswegian, is to be able to give a good headbutt. It's called a Glasgow kiss. So if you've managed to master that, it's a pretty good thing. But so after that, obviously, it's actually just a very warm and wonderful place, and I hope everyone gets to visit sometime. So I worked obviously in practice around the time of the financial crisis, and I think what happened to me at that point was this incredible sense that all the structures and systems that I took for granted, that I thought were natural, that I thought were unquestionable, unimpeachable, that they all fell apart, that they all just, these big banks that I was part of would be part of advising as part of my law firm, and whose existence I just took for granted, I thought would be there forever. They obviously collapsed in a very short space of time. And so, once that happens, you kind of feel much more confident to question the system, to question the premise of the financial markets regulation that it grew up in, to think harder about some of the assumptions that are made within that regulatory structure. And so that kind of grew my interest in being an academic. And that's really the path that I followed to Vanderbilt, which is a wonderful university. Please, come here, visit us. Come here. I'm the LLM director at Vanderbilt. We would love to see applications from HKU to be part of our community. We would love it. Love it, love it, love it. So please consider us. But you know, that's kind of been my my kind of path here in some ways. It's this very chastening period of the financial crisis that ultimately led to just a massive passion to think about what regulation is doing in shaping our financial system, in shaping how it innovates and changes over time, and how it can do a better job at serving the people it's supposed to in a real way.
Fabulous, fabulous. And yeah, it's a meaty topic, so really keen to hear your thoughts on this. So money and payments have seen a significant redesign in the last 10 years. I mean, with currency becoming increasingly digital, the use of cash having declined in many places since the pandemic. In some places like Sweden and China's major urban hubs, cashlessness is the norm, people paying with their phones. Technologies combining digital banking and smartphones have really spurred a rapid restructuring of the payments architecture for, you know, businesses and consumers on a day-to-day basis. So with that as the backdrop, what does the next decade of money and payments look like in your view?
It's an incredibly powerful and important question. These are the institutions, the structures, the processes that drive our everyday life. And when we think about the way in which we live today, we take it for granted that our payment system is going to work as it should. And we take it for granted that we can use just incredible amounts of technology to power that movement of money. Now, what's interesting is that this wasn't always the case, in that, you know, payment processes used to be extremely costly. So even though using cash seems like a very kind of very basic and normal and something, you know, that we've grown up doing, cash is not always the most convenient way to pay. It's incredibly expensive oftentimes for merchants that have to store the cash, look after the cash, hire, you know, hire security. They have to carry the cash to the bank. It can often be slower to process money using cash than using, you know, cashless ways of paying, for example, through your WeChat app or the Alipay app. You know, so the ways in which that we have, you know, grown up paying the cash medium that we've often, you know, taken for granted, that that had some advantages. It was a it's a relatively anonymous way of paying. It's very convenient. Things settle immediately as soon as you hand the money over. But it was also very costly. And payment used to be an extremely inefficient, costly process. And increasingly, what we've seen over the last 5-6 years, maybe even longer in some jurisdictions like the EU, payments has become a real source of business, of, you know, it's a source of innovation. It's a locus where many, many companies are competing for people to join their networks in order to encourage payments to not just be a service, but to also be something that can be combined with other kinds of services. For example, helping people to save money, connecting with social media, for example. So we're seeing a great deal of innovation in payments as a process, pushing it from that inefficient, expensive cash way of paying towards this, you know, very eclectic, technologically focused, highly mobile, you know, social media driven oftentimes process that is very exciting to watch. Now, a couple of things to highlight just to kind of begin this discussion is that this is a very exciting moment for the payments economy. Hong Kong has long been at the forefront of this kind of innovation, as I'm sure you're aware, Ajay. But there's a legal shift that is happening as economies move from being cash-based to being cashless-based forms of, forms of payment system for housing a cashless form of payment system. So specifically, when we use cash, we are using money that is defined legally as public money. So what that means is that cash is a promise made by the state to pay you the value of that bill or that note and, you know, or that coin that you're carrying in your pocket. This is money that is backstopped by the government. It carries, you know, essentially no credit risk here in the US. That is the theory. And so when we move towards cashless forms of payment, we're moving away from private money claims we're moving away from public money claims with very little credit risk towards private money claims that do carry credit risk, because these money claims are issued by banks or non-bank payment providers that can, as we know, fail. So as the economy digitizes, we're moving away from having cash, physical, state-backed money towards private money claims that do carry credit risk. And so what we're seeing around the world and looking forward to that 10-year, you know, horizon is government seeking to innovate on how they conceptualize, how they format, how they market public money so that it becomes much more portable, much more interesting to use. And so there's also a balance between public money and private money claims within the economy. So maybe I should stop there for just a minute so we can, you know, continue.
Yeah, you know, private claims still denominated in the coin of the realm, still denominated in the fiat currency, and that fiat currency is legal tender, at least within that jurisdiction. I don't mean to sound obtuse about it, but these are private claims denominated in legal tender of that domain, of that realm. So I can see why maybe then nation states aren't as concerned about it. It's only when you start talking about alternatives that they don't control, which we can get to shortly, that they may tend to freak out, because again, the sovereign wants to, a recurring theme on this show is the sovereign wants to be the one to mint the coin of the realm.
I mean, there's certainly carrying the denomination of fiat denominations. There's no question about that. Yep. It's just that, you know, the nature of the liability that, for example, if I deposit money in a bank, that is debt that the bank owes to me, right? So the money that, you know, that is a contractual claim that the bank owes to me. The bank can fail tomorrow and I have to stand in line hoping to get my money back.
But oftentimes it's going to be backstopped by creditor deposit.
Absolutely.
Right?
So this is how we make money usable. This is how we make money safer to use. But at the same time, there are institutions that, you know, do fail. So for example, here in the US, Silicon Valley Bank in March 2023, underwent a significant crisis. There, the big concern was that all of these startups had money held with Silicon Valley Bank over the insured threshold, and they were going to lose all of that money because that, you know, that bank was going to go under. So there is a credit risk when one puts money with a bank, uses that, you know, money in order to be able to, you know, pay for goods and services. The bank can fail. Those money claims can essentially, you know, turn to nothing because the debtor does not have enough money to pay you back. So that essentially is the difference between having, you know, public money, which the state is always going to promise to pay you back, doesn't matter, you know, no matter what, versus private money claims, which are administered through private intermediaries like banks, private payment providers like WeChat, Alipay, et cetera.
The next point I'd like to come to is the design of such payment systems. And that's, I guess, I'd like to impress upon our listeners that that's important for the efficient operation of any economy, because if such payment systems aren't designed right, that tends to slow down the number of transactions, if not reduce the number of transactions outright, and to drag on economic growth. So if we look at the capacity to rapidly scale digital payment solutions, that's enabled businesses and people to navigate commerce during the pandemic. So, you know, P2P, peer-to-peer, real-time payments, tools such as Faster Payments, Swish, and Venmo in the U.S. allowed people to engage economically with each other in ways they couldn't do before, such as, you know, in an earlier age, and still to some extent now, you have to go to the ATM to get cash. You have to wait to pay a bill. Your impressions about the importance of design?
Design is everything. How one designs the payment system is so fundamental to how money moves within the economy. I mean, it's incredible to me how, you know, we consider something as fundamental as payments as to basically be a logistical afterthought, when in fact, the efficiency of payments...
They think of it as a tech issue.
Yeah, as an operational back office thing, right?
But
as we saw during the pandemic, the ability to make digital payments was fundamentally a pillar of how businesses and human beings were able to survive. If we lived in an earlier age, you know, we would have to go into the shop, we would have to take a risk, we would have to, you know, go to the ATMs and take risks. But, you know, because we had that technology that would allow value to move digitally, allow payments to settle instantly, that people not only were able to make payments, but they also had that economic security that money could be used instantly for their own, you know, for their own consumption. So, you know, but the interesting thing is that the design of payment systems is fundamental. And it, you can see that that quality when you look at and compare jurisdictions, you know, across the world. And, you know, I'm in America here, and the payment system in America, in my opinion, is extremely antiquated in its design. So, you know, it might seem like we are inhabiting this, you know, incredibly innovating payment system, and we are on some level. But the fundamental infrastructure on which the system is based is, you know, is becoming very creaky. It's very slow, it's very expensive, and it's inefficient. So, you know, in the US, it's imperative for people to have a bank account in order to be able to access fulsome payment services. There are many populations in the US that do not have access or have patchier access to banking. So, for example, poorer households, lower-income households, communities of color, households with disabilities, single-parent households lack access to banking or lack the fullest access to banking services. And therefore, they're using, you know, cash much more often than more affluent, you know, peers within society. So, for example, there was a survey done in 2021, I believe, that showed that approximately 60% of Americans earning $100,000 or more annually did none of their purchases weekly in cash, zero. By contrast, approximately something like 30% of Black Americans and Americans earning less than, you know, approximately 30%, 30-something percent of Black Americans were doing all of their weekly purchases in cash. Right, so one can see a structural architectural disparity in being able to access payment services, depending on, you know, whether or not one has a bank account. And that's a question of architecture. That's a question of payment system design. Compare that with Brazil, for example, which, you know, in 2021 brought in a new payment scheme called PIX. PIX is a payment scheme that, you know, has been an incredible success.
You can use it at the beach. You can use it
at the beach. You know, this is what has banks, non-banks. The entire purpose of PIX was to be a, you know, inclusion-focused payment scheme.
Yeah.
They have brought in folks. You know, there's articles that are being written about people in the street economy that are taking tips using PIX. Right? So one sees a very different architecture depending on the ways in which the design of the payment system is conceived. In the U.S., for example, it's very bank-focused, so that restricts access to those who don't have a bank account. Take other countries, for example, Brazil, the U.K. in some parts, looking at, you know, India, that's transformed a number of non-banks like Postal Service, Paytm, and others into banks, you know, to focus on inclusion and broadening access to the payment system. And that has enabled digitization to basically have a much more powerful impact, and for its efficiencies to therefore be much more widespread.
With your point in the U.S., I think there's some key exceptions to that, because certainly what I've seen, and I don't mean to single out these communities, but with the South Asians, the Middle Easterners, with the East Asians, even the Chinese, the Koreans, the Indians, the Iranians, the Arabs, the Lebanese, they high income groups that like to use cash. And frankly, that enables them to fiddle with their books, downplay the amount they have to pay in tax. So, I think culture weighs into this quite a bit. But I'm glad you brought up the issue of financial inclusion, because this ties into the next point I want to raise with you, which is that even as payments have scaled, there are serious inefficiencies in the online paying system, and you alluded to some of those that especially with the U.S. dollar system, than the U.S., even as the user experience has been digitized, i.e. with smartphones, that settlement often takes several days in some cases, and that the system is under-inclusive, especially with regards to communities of color who continue to use cash extensively owing to the lack of affordable banking, check cashing services and the like.
Right.
So for businesses, international U.S. dollar transfers are very expensive and take time, meaning delays and the systematic cost on anyone that sends U.S. dollar transfers abroad regularly. What are the fixes?
It's interesting. I mean, it's coming back to your first question, Ajay, which is, what does the future look like?
Yeah.
So, you know, when one looks at the U.S. dollar payment system, it's arguably one of, you know, it's the reserve currency globally of trade. 70% approximately, according to one study, of trade is denominated in U.S. dollar. And so having an international U.S. dollar payment system,
provides... Safe haven in times of crisis. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so having that U.S. dollar payment system that is hyper-efficient, quick settlement in, you know, real time, that's the aspirational goal that can cement and further deepen America's, you know, dominance within the global monetary architecture, if it can achieve that. Coming back to that question that you're discussing previously, which is, you know, how does one try and improve potentially the efficiencies of the international U.S. dollar payment system? So one idea that has been, you know, being pushed is that of, you know, U.S. dollar denominated pegged stable coins. Now, the interesting thing about stable coins, this is the crypto type of innovation where one token, one digital token, is pegged to the value of $1. These are tokens that move on, that transfer on public blockchains that are global in nature. In addition, these are open systems. So one does not need to qualify to be a bank in order to participate on a blockchain. And so with these more open international payment rails where money transfers are happening pegged to a, you know, dollar peg token, then these are being put forward as potential solutions to make dollar payments internationally move much more faster, much more cheaply than they do today. But this would be a system, this is, you know, posited as a system that moves away from the bank-based international payment system that exists today towards a more open payment system where, you know, one doesn't have to be a bank to participate. That's a radical sea change from the traditional norm. But what it is showing, at least in smaller scales as presently, you know, tested, is that payments do move faster. They cost, you know, very little amounts to transfer. And so one interesting use case that is emerging here, you know, is helping folks who are, you know, for example, displaced people, to move money across borders cheaply, to do so at very low cost to themselves. And it's a kind of smaller test environment to, you know, to see whether or not stable coins can provide a kind of structural rail for U.S. dollar payment systems and those denominated in other countries like euro to move much more faster and cheaply than they do currently.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound too bleak. I mean, digital asset solutions are emerging, like stable coins, where,
yeah,
you know, tokenized representations of currencies like the dollar or the euro move on rapidly on computer networks, you know, i.e. blockchains, moving money in minutes and cheaply. And these might hold up potential for businesses looking to send money overseas affordably and quickly. And beyond that, you know, governments are proposing their own digitized versions of currency, CBDCs.
That's right.
As a way to create more efficient payment systems and substitutes for cash. And the CBDC trials are well underway in the UAE.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and China.
And China, the digital euro and the digital dollar are also being considered. But yeah, you're right. China's well down the road of ushering in a digital yuan.
Absolutely. You know, and so it's interesting to see, like, how the CBDC race came about. You know, it came about in response initially to Facebook's attempt to create a global kind of quasi stable coin at that time. I don't know if you remember, Ajay, but Facebook had trialed its Libra coin.
I do recall that. Yeah.
You know, which
CNBC was skeptical at the time.
Oh, I think a lot of people were skeptical at the time. There were hearings here in the U.S., congressional hearings, where, you know, lawmakers were, you know, absolutely terrified at the prospect of Facebook with 2 billion users operating essentially as a extra sovereign entity that would be providing payment services around the globe using this Libra coin. And so that has spurred innovation in central bank payment systems. And so one has seen experimentation with CBDC is, you know, is something that is becoming very, very common across the world. I think there are, you know, well over 120 trials underway for CBDCs in the different national fiat currencies. So this is an attempt to kind of modernize the format of public money, which really hasn't undergone a whole lot of change for a very long time indeed.
Several things hurt Facebook in that they were already in the public eye because of, you know, their role in the 2006 election, issues over data privacy, you know, their storing of the, you know, customer data, passing it on to other parties. I mean, they were already being scrutinized. And that, you know, talking about creating your own currency when the feeling was you're already in an advantageous position that many nation states would not want you to be in.
Yeah.
Did not help their case. But I mean, if we look at the solutions, right, one has to ask, are these even viable if they hold promise? I mean, because stablecoins come with risks. I mean, as you stated, there are claims against private issuers.
Absolutely. And
predominantly, you know, as of right now, all non-banks, and there's a clear risk that they may not be safe. So then where are people to look? Where is the...
You know, so this is why, Ajay, like, we're in regulatory ramblings. You know, this is our job as folks engaged in policy and regulation to mitigate these risks through ways that can afford the convenience, efficiency, and cost savings of, you know, payment innovations whilst minimizing some of the risks that they pose. So in the case of stablecoins, for example, the big risk mitigant, the big control, is to make sure that the issuer is maintaining a sufficient reserve of assets to back the claims that it issues. So the issuer, you know, a non-bank issuer, for example, must keep a certain, you know, should keep, to make this safe, you know, a certain amount of very high quality liquid assets, you know, in its vault in order to be able to pay out in the event that it needs to redeem these claims and customers need to redeem these claims. In addition, it's important that the issuer has a safe place to put these assets. So it might hold them with the central bank, for example. In addition to that, we can have issuers potentially be very transparent about the quality and quantity of their reserves. We can have, you know, these issuers be inspected on a regular basis by, you know, the central bank, for example, and others. So there are ways in which we are able to think about solutions to mitigating the risk posed by these issuers. That doesn't mean there's no risk. That doesn't mean, obviously, that there's no stability problems. I think that has to be addressed. It's the big elephant in the room with any of these digital asset solutions. They are new. They have less testing than cash and bank-based systems. But, you know, we're looking at the payments environment for the next 10 years and where it's going to go. And finding a solution for international payments is a massive priority in this world because they are just incredibly inefficient and costly at present.
It is new, it is novel, it is innovative, it isn't, people don't trust it as much as cash. But the gains are too huge to be ignored in terms of, you know, turnover, in terms of circulating currency multiple times within the community and generating economic activity. That the gains are too great with this new technology to overlook it. Now, clearly, regulatory policy is going to be key then, globally.
Absolutely.
There needs to be clarity on ensuring robust standards so that businesses can be part of cross-border stablecoin networks. I mean, currently that coordination and clarity doesn't exist in the U.S. regulatory policy seems to be, at least in relation to crypto, it doesn't appear to be tilting towards enabling widespread uptake. I mean, so they're favoring status quo. But then you look at CBDCs, and they come with many issues for uptake, primarily how to deal with suspicions about government and data collection, surveillance,
exactly,
and payment systems,
exactly,
and the trust in the state to oversee large-scale payment systems.
It's a very tough one. And, you know, it's a tough one. And I think with respect to standards, Ajay, I think you make an incredibly important and powerful point here, which is that globally, we are failing on global standard setting for digital asset technologies, for coordination on you know, interoperability standards for CBDCs, if different countries go forward with that. We have no playbook, we have no standards, we have no real deeper coordination happening on that international level. Now, this is very, very contrasting with what happened after the financial crisis and post-crisis bank and securities markets regulation and, you know, and derivatives regulation, where countries came together, G20 came together very, very closely to align regulatory standards and implement them in their home jurisdictions. That process was, you know, fairly, I would say, you know, incredibly successful. And so it's startling to see the contrast today. The EU has moved forward with the market in crypto assets regulation, MiCA. So they put their own kind of, you know, foot forward. The US is nowhere close, unfortunately. We're very, very behind on the international scene. That's a loss in US leadership, which has traditionally been very forward in this space, but the US is nowhere to be seen. Singapore, UAE, you know, are doing their own thing. So this fragmentation obviously holds enormous dangers for regulatory arbitrage, where issuers might establish themselves in the lowest cost jurisdiction to do business, where the standards are potentially lower, but causing risk to others in different countries. So, you know, CBDC standards not being interoperable means that we have the same problems when making international payments, even though we're using digital technologies. So, you know, the costs of a lack of international alignment are profound, and it's a real sad indictment on our regulatory coordination processes that we're not pushing these standards, you know, far enough and fast enough at present. So, you know, this is definitely an issue that I think you really put your finger on, which I think is very costly for the pace of innovation going forward and its success ultimately, if it's not done safely and securely for people around the world.
If I take a step back, and I'm coming at this as a layperson, I'm not tech savvy by any means, but if I take a step back and if I look at this as an individual on the street, it occurs to me, without having thought about it too deeply, but it does occur to me that there are risks attended with a highly bank-centric payment system as well, as in the case of the U.S., maybe less so in the EU. But I mean, as we saw with the bank collapses in March 23, in the U.S., the bank collapses mean that payment systems can also be disrupted. I mean,
absolutely,
the collapse of Signature Bank, it caused a big disruption to the Signet payment system. So, and beyond that, money kept by non-bank payment providers at U.S. banks was also in peril, where accounts exceeded the federal insurance limit. Circle had over $3 billion in cash reserves held at SVB. I mean, I think we can articulate the problem, but no easy answers.
There's no perfect world, as you say, Ajay. Yeah. Like it's a very, you know, it's a system of trade-offs and trying to explore, you know, essentially also producing some level of choice, heterogeneity within the payment system as well, so people can opt into mechanisms that suit their appetites the best. You know, so for example, when you look at things like a CBDC, it doesn't necessarily mean that you get rid of cash. You know, like people might still want to have physical cash. You know, folks like the fact of using cash in certain circumstances. For example, they would prefer the anonymity of using cash. They prefer the fact you can just hand it over to someone. But you know, having a CBDC with cash might mean that if folks want to have a digital public money account, that can provide some state-backed public claims to the preponderance, to the dominance of private market claims in the economy. So coming back to the point you just made about the banking system being so key to payments, you know, in the case of SVB, for example, when it was collapsing, there were serious worries whether people would be paid their salaries on the Monday. There'd be serious worries about whether the bills would be paid on that Monday. So having some level of diversity, heterogeneity, having choice in the market where, you know, you don't just have a market that's just private claims orientated. So if there's a big bank collapse or a big, you know, gigantic, you know, private payment services provided that collapses, that people feel somehow that, you know, their lives are going to end. That, you know, there is some security also from having some state-backed claims, from having state backing of private claims, as you noted. But, you know, obviously there's limits to that. So having that level of diversity within the payments environment can create some natural hedges against, you know, serious shocks to the system as a whole.
I also feel it's important to look at the tensions arising from the current trend towards digitization, that is, the shift away from publicly backed money towards privately issued money, you know, digitally issued commercial banks and non-bank money claims. That for many of the techno-libertarians who are some of the loudest advocates of cryptocurrency and virtual assets, that would be the ideal, that in a truly free market, the libertarian ideal, creditors would issue their own currency.
We live in our society where the nature of money obviously is ephemeral, and the extent to which money has value, money has power, comes from how it's backed and how it's, you know, the institutions that support its, you know, its function. In order for money to have more than just paper power, it needs to be backstopped by some, you know, some credibility. In previous eras, we used to have what's called commodity money, where the money would literally be gold, or copper or silver, so that it would carry some intrinsic value. Today, obviously, we don't do that.
Or different states in the U.S. issuing their own currency.
And exactly.
How, once upon a time, the payment across states was difficult.
Oh, yeah. They would have, you know, you would have these tallies that would be issued by private banks in different states. And so, you know, so this is about how money is able to achieve the aims it's supposed to achieve, to be scalable, to have purchasing power, to have economic and monetary power, to be able to generate powerful networks where merchants, people, everyone can believe in the quality of that money that ultimately, you know, comes with some kind of backing to that money claim. And traditionally, of course, that has rested with the state as the provider of that institutional backstop. So, you know, there have obviously been many attempts to create some smaller private money communities. So in the US, for example, there was an interesting one where, I don't know if you've heard of Tide Pods, which are these detergents to wash clothes with.
Yes.
So they were used as the currency of choice to exchange for drugs. So, you know, they used to be this, it was, you know, a couple of years back, this kind of wave where Tide became a kind of medium of exchange for drugs. But obviously, that's not a scalable solution. That's not a networked-based solution. That's not a, you know, practical solution for the economy as a whole. So, you know, there's certainly attempts to create smaller communities we're living in a society where we have to interact economically with other agents, internationally with other countries. So the money needs to have some power, I guess, to support its overall deployment.
I want to come back to something you said about, okay, Singapore and the UAE are doing their own thing. So we're seeing a lot of different laboratories with this, you know, experimentation in this field around the world. Some might say that's a good thing, that enables the fence sitters like Hong Kong to like to take the slow, steady, deliberative approach to pick and choose the best practices from around the world. As far as your earlier point about Hong Kong being on the cutting edge of payment systems, I think that was true 20 years ago when you had the Octopus card, and you know that card was as good as cash, and it was accepted by many vendors. I think Hong Kong is become complacent and falling behind many parts of the world. I mean, and even as far back as 2008, people were saying to me, look at the ATM machines in Thailand and all the things you can do with them. That what we have in Hong Kong are vestiges of the 70s and 80s. But it also comes down to the sunk costs and the investment that's been made and, you know, jurisdictions that say with India, certain African nations, they got to leapfrog several generations of technology by going straight into digital when it came to telecommunications. And so the later adopters have the benefit of adopting newer technology. But I mean, when it comes to, I want to focus specifically on the UAE. It's landmark what they did in terms of the Virtual Asset Regulatory Authority, the world's first such regulator, catering to this market, specializing in this field. But another way to look at it is that it's a regulator that's custom fit for the industry. And in a sense, they're giving the industry everything they want, light touch regulation, and that's why you're seeing so much money flocking to their shores in this space.
You know, this is in story as old as time, frankly, which is international competition for capital. We saw in the case of banking,
yeah,
for example.
Regulatory arbitrage. Yeah.
Regulatory arbitrage all day long, right? Which is, you know, one tries to create a very hospitable environment for money to come in. You know, jurisdictions tried it.
Being business friendly is a good thing, but again, all things within limits, right?
You know, we had Iceland, Dublin, yeah. I mean, Ireland, where, yeah. you know, banking standards were, you know, was designed to attract, you know, businesses, banks and others to come be there. But obviously there was, you know, ultimately excessive tolerance for risk taking. The goal of international financial standard setting is generally to create a baseline, right? To agree on a floor that everyone can basically have some common playbook to say, these are the risks that we all are not comfortable with, and there is no question that any one of us will reduce the compliance burden on the companies coming here simply to accommodate a quote unquote friendlier business climate. Now, in the case of FTX, for example, we've seen the cost of that, you know, overly friendly approach, which is the Bahamas that provided an excessively hospitable you know, environment for FTX to establish itself. It developed deep ties in the economy. And now, you know, the reputational hit that the Bahamas has taken as a result is extremely costly, right? Like it's an extreme, and not to mention the hit to the local economy. So
they were never really a serious player in the financial world, right?
They did try. They definitely did try and promote themselves, and arguably are still continuing to promote themselves as a hub for you know, for digital asset businesses. This is digital assets has been an opportunity for quote unquote non-traditional jurisdictions to promote themselves as tech savvy expert regulators. And so a number of countries have tried that approach to showcase their skills in that regard. At the same time, obviously, having, you know, limited, without bringing sufficient expertise, without, you know, creating standard setting, without, you know, having a conversation about what standards should exist, there's a huge risk, particularly to smaller countries that have less financial slack to be able to support their local communities.
That's what I'm saying. It's one thing when a meltdown happens in the U.S., where they've got established regulatory systems, that you know that the enforcement resources and mechanisms are there, and the U.S. has got deep capital markets; they can absorb the shock.
Right.
I wonder what Dubai is going to do if things go awry. And coming back to your other point about the Bahamas, I think once your reputation as a financial hub is shot, kind of see shades of that in Hong Kong, sadly, nowadays. But once your reputation as a financial hub is shot, good luck getting back to that level of preeminence ever again. I mean, when I think about Cyprus and what happened a decade ago with the bail-in, and now you see them still trying to market themselves overseas, I'm like, give it up. A lot of people have long memories. People haven't forgotten what you've done.
Yeah. And you know, so much of international capital markets is all about this quote-unquote bonding, right? That you connect yourself to reputable regulatory environments in order to showcase your own credibility. It's a sign of, you know, businesses attaching themselves to brand name hubs as a way to show that they are serious about being regulated and serious about regulation. And ultimately, at least the theory goes, that should lower your cost of capital, that should help you attract customers and so forth, who feel much more confident. And so, you know, it's in everyone's interest, it's in the business interest of countries to be good regulators, because ultimately, you know, it does pay off where highly, you know, credible companies want to establish in your jurisdiction to show off, you know, how well they're regulated as a means of generating business and profile and making customers feel at ease about doing business with that company. So, you know, there is a strong business case to be made for being serious regulators, even though the lure of international, you know, regulatory competition is very powerful.
I mean, I guess the crux of it is that everyone wants to know, based on all that we've discussed, do you think that the potential for blockchain-based decentralized finance is upwards, or is it going to be full of valleys and peaks and troughs, and it's going to be an uncertain ride, like as with most asset classes?
No, it's really interesting to see how decentralized finance, the cryptocurrencies, you know, are evolving. There is an immense amount of sophistication that is growing around the so-called DeFi, decentralized finance ecosystem. New kinds of financial applications like lending and other lending applications, insurance applications, and others that are coming to fruition. One is seeing them operating in this DeFi space. And so clearly there's activity here. At the same time, I think we all have to acknowledge the need for regulators. We're on this show doing rambling. So that for regulators to be, you know, to be part of this development, like it cannot happen just by itself without standards, without safety, without having people, you know what they're getting into through disclosure, through education, through literacy about the risks and the opportunities that they're looking to take. So, you know, I think this space needs some of that regulatory maturing. Hopefully it's coming. I think that the need for that has become incredibly clear. What's also kind of interesting from my standpoint is to see the geographical dimensions of this, which is that some countries have taken to DeFi more than others. For example, when you look at certain countries with less developed financial markets, less developed payment systems, there is a very active embrace of crypto, cryptocurrencies. So one sees crypto being used in remittances a lot. One sees crypto being used by countries like, you know, Venezuela and Cuba and other places that have been left out of the international banking system. One sees crypto being used in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa, for example. It's a very high usage there because local systems are not trusted or don't exist. And so, you know, this kind of embrace of decentralized finance and blockchains can have particular appeal where documentation systems are not well developed. So, you know, people might steal your property. So having a blockchain-based automated verification system for identity and documentation and, you know, and property rights and so forth can be very useful. So there is this kind of interesting space where one is viewing DeFi development, embrace, knowledge, literacy, comfort, move at different paces depending on where people are located. In Hong Kong, for example, you have a great financial system. They're very sophisticated in general. The US, for example, the need for that, the everyday need for that is arguably lower than in other countries where some folks have really taken to DeFi, to crypto, much more enthusiastically than in other places.
Is it prudent? No, because the US, I mean, the SEC seems to be spearheading the efforts in this space. And is it prudent to treat crypto like a security?
I mean, that's the big conversation that's happening here, whether it's a security, you know, or whether it's a commodity, whether there's some kind of new kind of
legal and applying the SEC Howey test and that's what people overseas dread, to be ensnared in U.S. securities regulation.
That's the gazillion dollar question here in the U.S. as to, and there, you know, numerous, there's a ton of litigation underway. And so, you know, one has to keep an eye on this, obviously. This debate is ongoing. Ultimately, I think it's probably going to need to be solved through legislation, with Congress having to come through with some kind of solution to decide how to oversee crypto assets. Some bills have been put forward. As of last year, there was, you know, the bill pioneered by Senators Lummis and Gillibrand that sought to create a compromise regime between the CFTC and the SEC. But unfortunately, there is congressional gridlock here in the U.S., so that action is not happening as fast as it arguably should. And so there's a lot of litigation underway at present to resolve this question or to move forward with this question of whether certain kinds of crypto assets or securities, commodities, currencies, some other category, whatever.
Yeah, those judicial challenges, I think, were largely expected. I mean, it's been a very unproductive session of Congress. These past 2 years, those of us that follow such things. Those were all the questions I had for you. Was there anything you wanted to, any impressions you wanted to, anything you wanted to impress upon our audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main takeaway I have is that this is a very exciting time to be in payments. I think it's a very exciting time to be engaged in conversations around disintermediation within finance, move away from traditional, so-called traditional finance towards, you know, more, you know, this more it's kind of technologically focused payments and financial market system where technological expertise is carrying its own particular value. And so this is a very exciting time, Ajay, to do what you do, which is spreading this kind of conversation, having discussions about the issues involved. And so I'm just so grateful to get to, you know, be one very small part of this. And I'm very excited to see what, you know, you're going to do next with respect to kind of deepening, understanding conversation, just thinking around some of these very tough questions. And as we've kind of discussed over the course of this podcast, they are not being answered fast enough and deeply enough as we would want by the international regulatory community.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time, but one last question, because we are affiliated with HKU's law school and students will be watching. It hasn't led to fewer students envisaging a future for themselves in the field of financial law and regulation. But based on all the things we've discussed, it's a very different world from that which came before the global financial crisis or the subprime meltdown. It's going to be more technology is going to play a big part of that. Any advice you would give our students?
Yeah, look, I mean, this is the best thing for HKU students, honest to God, which is having these, you know, shocks of the system that disrupt incumbency expertise and make room for new people, new entrants to develop interesting ways to see the world and interesting, you know, specialties that they can then use to contribute, you know, to their jobs and to firm life and beyond in public service. So for example, right, when you mentioned the financial crisis, so afterwards, you know, there was a huge amount of, as you know, interest in fintech, right? So we saw like huge amounts of growth in disintermediating the financial system through non-bank entities, having much more technologically focused financial services provision, having automated services to provide things like insurance and other things, chatbots for banking and so forth. So like a huge amount of innovation around tech. And so that really favored those that were willing to get their hands dirty, that were willing to learn, to go online, take courses, that were, you know, going to do that extra work, because that put them, you know, much more, you know, that put them ahead actually in some ways of legacy incumbent partners that perhaps didn't have that level of facility with the changes that were happening. So for students, this is, you know, a great opportunity to be nimble, but also to never forget, it's not just about learning the law. Please don't think that that's where your perimeter lies. It's really about understanding the, you know, always understanding technologies, get the structure, be, you know, take time to understand some of the engineering, take time to get to have conversations with real people who are working in the business environment to learn that business, because you will never, ever, ever lose by doing that. You have so much to gain, because that sets you apart from every other person that comes in naively thinking that the law is just about the law. It never is about the law. It's about the kind of communities that you're trying to serve, and to learning as much as you can about them, about what's moving them, what changes are ahead, putting your hat on and thinking, how will the world change in 5 years and how can I make myself a real player for that 5 year change? You know, that's something that's gonna make you, you know, stand out from the crowd. And that's what you're here to do at HKU. It's such a phenomenal institution. You have an amazing platform to move forward with that, you know, to be the leaders of tomorrow, business-wise, public service-wise, in every way as a regulator, policy thought leader. So, you know, the world's your oyster. Please, you know, take that opportunity.
I think that's a wonderful note to end it on. Yisha, thank you so much for joining us.
Ajay, thank you so very much for having me. It's been such an honor, and I would always be delighted to have many more conversations with you.
Yeah, well, we will do it again for sure. And to our listeners, thank you again. Till next time.